This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 159 of the Intercooler Podcast, everybody, with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel, my co-host. And we're joined this week by a guest, Gavin Green, who is an eminent Australian car journalist, been living and working in the UK for a few decades now, former editor of Car Magazine, and now contributing to the Intercooler. He's a fantastic writer. We are delighted to have him on board. And in this episode, he explains, he talks about his early racing career and the crash that pretty much ended it all. He also talks about how he got involved in car journalism, how and why he came over to Europe. And he talks about editing Car Magazine. It's an interesting discussion. And we also talk about what's going on in the market now that it's 3 years since COVID hit and caused all sorts of issues in the car market. Before we get into that, though, please let me remind you all to rate and review the podcast. It's really important. It helps us a lot. And while you're doing it, just open up the app, whichever app you're using to listen to this podcast, and hit the follow button or hit the subscribe button. It really helps. And it doesn't take you more than a couple of seconds. So please do that and enjoy the episode. We're joined this week by one of our newer writers, but also one of our most illustrious writers, Gavin Green. Gavin, good to have you on the podcast. Now, it's a good time to have you on the podcast because as we record this, we've just published your most recent piece for the Intercooler, which is about the Skyline GTR and the GTR that followed, the R35. Now, you wrote a lovely, quite personal piece about the time you have spent with those two cars. Just give us a few words on what the Skyline GTR and the GTR mean to you, because I think it will open up an interesting discussion with Andrew, who perhaps doesn't feel quite as strongly towards the fast Nissans as you do.
And well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here. So thank you, Dan and Andrew. I have quite a special place. Well, the GTR has quite a special place in my heart, only because I drove it when it was very new, before I think I was certainly one of the first European journalists to drive it. And it came about in the late 80s when Kevin Radley, 1989, when Kevin Radley, Car's Japanese editor, said, "You really need to drive this car. It's absolutely awesome." And because Nissan didn't have much of a reputation then for performance cars, I have to say I was somewhat sceptical about how good he said this car was. And he then told me that he'd managed to gate crash me into a Japanese journalist test at the Nürburgring just for Japanese journalists. So I agreed to go, somewhat reluctantly, and went and drove this R32 Skyline GTR around the ring. And frankly, I just couldn't believe how good it was. We, as I said in my story in the Intercooler today, Nissan had the very good fortune. The day that we did it, there was a track test run by a German motoring magazine using professional drivers and things like BMW M5s, Porsche 928s. And the journalists in the GTR, the Skyline GTR, were quicker than the pros and the Porsches and BMWs. And I think that just gave an idea of just how incredibly capable this car was. And it's a car that I've always rather liked since then.
Yeah, and then followed up 20 years later by the R35 model. And you seem to enjoy the R35 GTR as well.
I did, very much. I mean, I haven't driven it, to be honest, for well over 10 years, so I haven't driven the very newest version. But I was asked to go and track test a prototype before it went on sale, before it was even launched, in fact. And at a place called Sendai, which is north of Tokyo. It's a short racing circuit, but a little bit like a mini Nürburgring with lots of crests and fast corners. And again, I just thought, what an incredible piece of kit it was. So, I mean, I think latterly, it's got a bit old and it's a pretty heavy old thing, but it's still an incredible technical achievement, I think. And now this car is, 16 years old?
Yeah, I think it is. I was looking it up. It has just gone off sale in the UK. I actually rang Nissan because it's not on their website anymore, but you can still buy it in the US and in Japan, so it's still in production. And I think the only other car that is still in production that is as old as that car is the Fiat 500.
Mm. It's quite something, yeah. Isn't it? It really
so
is quite something.
I mean, it's certainly, it's got the most extraordinary longevity. But I did drive one quite recently, just as a kind of like a sort of farewell valedictory piece. And although I've always been a bit critical of them because they've been, you know, heavy and expensive, and I kind of always thought I might rather be in some kind of Evo Mitsubishi or something like that, which would be like more practical and half the price. I was rather charmed by it this time.
Oh, interesting.
Because I wasn't really looking at it as a kind of like a new car. It was almost, and you know, and the market and the cars that are out now are so very different. And it has a charm. It has a very analog feel to it, which is increasingly rare these days. That engine is still, that hand-built engine is still absolutely amazing. And I just really enjoyed smoking about in the thing for a bit.
And also, it's easy to forget that, you know, that the GTR, Skyline GTR, the R32, was launched in 1989. And that's the same year as the MX-5 and the Honda NSX, and in fact, the Lexus LS400. And it is amazing.
What a year.
It is amazing that arguably, Andrew and Dan, you could argue they're the four greatest Japanese cars, frankly, since 1989. I mean, they were wonderful cars, and all coming out in the same year.
I mean, Gavin, you will remember, sadly Dan won't remember because he was three at the time, but you and I will remember that sense of, because, you know, there was the Skyline and the 300ZX was coming, and there was, as you say, there was the MX-5 and the NSX and then the LS400, and actually even the Nissan Micra, there were these world-class cars coming out of Japan, and I can remember that sense of the European industry just going, what are we going to do about this? Because we just thought these guys were going to come over and just, you know, totally destroy everything that we'd always sort of, you know, imagined to be the way things were in the business. And it's just strange that it didn't really happen.
No, we had a heading in Car, I think it was to me about 1989, which said, Japan teaches Europe how to build sports cars. That was our front page, our cover. And they did. But you're right. I mean, that was the very end of the sort of the great years of Japanese industry too. In the 90s, of course, they had the sort of the whole economy slowed down, and suddenly they just lost that tremendous confidence that they seemed to be building as the 80s progressed. And they've never really regained it. Now, of course, in EVs, we definitely see the baton changing towards Korea and increasingly China.
Korea, absolutely.
Yeah. China. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
No, I was just going to, I mean, I think really, because there will be some people listening to this, there'll be many people who know exactly who Gavin is and have, you know, subscribed to Car Magazine and have been reading his work there and elsewhere for decades, but there will be some who don't. So, I mean, can you just tell us a bit about you? So you're clearly one of the many, you're a member of the Australian Mafia, the group of Australians who basically came over here in the 70s and 80s and showed us how to be motoring journalists, you know, and I grew up on, actually not so much your work, only because, you know, you're not much older than me, but, you know, obviously Nichols and Cropley and Ian Fraser and, you know, all your predecessors, you know, it's thanks to you lot that I do what I do, because you sort of lit the fire when I was a kid. And then you were in Australia. Were you working as a motoring journalist in Australia? Because I know you were racing over there.
I wasn't. That's where I'm different from my predecessors. And my predecessors in order were Doug Blain, Ian Fraser, Mel Nichols, and Steve Cropley. So they were the four Australians that edited Car before me from essentially the mid-60s till late 80s, which is when I took over, or 87 I took over. They all had, as I understand it, were motoring journalists in Australia, although before that they all had newspaper backgrounds, which I think is relevant because I think we were taught journalistic skills that perhaps some of them, the contemporary motoring journalists in Britain in the 60s, 70s and 80s didn't have. But they're all newspaper journalists who, in the case of those four, they also went on to be motoring journalists. And Steve Cropley, very memorably working for Peter Robinson, of course, another intercooler contributor. I didn't work as a motoring journalist in Australia. I was a newspaper journalist on the Sydney Morning Herald and the Sydney Sun Herald, owned by John Fairfax. So they were newspapers. I'd never written about cars in my life until I came to the UK. But my dad was a well-known Australian rally driver and was essentially the Murray Walker of Australian television. He was the main commentator for Channel 7's motorsport coverage through from the late 60s all the way through to the 80s. So, you know, he got me into motor racing, really. And my interest as a kid was not so much the motor industry, it was more car racing. And I was particularly fascinated by Formula One in Europe. My Christmas and birthday presents were airmail subscriptions to Autosport and Motoring News. And in those days, they both came out on a Thursday, and they arrived in Australia with a bit of luck the following Monday. And if they didn't, I was devastated. It ruined my week. And I particularly loved, my favourite motoring journalist was an American Formula One reporter called Pete Lyons, who wrote race reports for Autosport in the 70s. And I thought he was just wonderful, the atmospheric way he painted Formula One racing. So my real love was motor racing, and I wanted to be a racing driver as a kid. We know that many, many young boys want to be racing drivers as young boys, but at 18 I still wanted to be one, and I ended up buying a Formula V, which is a little single-seat racing car powered by a Volkswagen engine. In Australia in those days, Formula V was bigger than Formula Ford, more competitive. There were many more races. It was also cheaper. And I started racing as a 19-year-old in 1976. And I was fortunate that I was, you know, I must have had a bit of talent because I was winning races halfway through the year against sort of very experienced old hands. I was voted best young newcomer by the Australian Racing Drivers Club at the end of 1976. And, you know, journalists are writing nice things about me as being a young driver with potential. I kept racing Formula V through 1977, was dicing for the lead of the state championship, the New South Wales championship, and then had a pretty horrendous accident in August of 1977, almost exactly a year after I'd won my first race, and badly smashed up my right leg. And I had planned to go into Formula Ford the following year. I had a sponsor, I had a car all organised. But obviously that put that on hold. And I did go into Formula Ford in late 78, early 79. But then, you know, I didn't win any races in Formula Ford, but I got plenty of seconds, thirds and fourths. But, you know, I think I heard a podcast you did earlier on overrated and underrated racing drivers. And I think Dan made the point about Johnny Herbert having his back accident, never being quite as fast afterwards as he was before. I'm not so arrogant as in any way to compare myself with Johnny Herbert, but I think there is something about a young driver having a really bad accident. And I think I probably was never quite as competitive afterwards, after that crash, to be really honest with you. I think you're suddenly aware, age 20, that you're mortal. And even though I survived that, I survived that accident, but a motor racing photographer called Lance Rooting, who photographed me crashing, it was also on television live. My mother was watching it, doing the ironing. I think she burnt my favourite shirt. But and also, I might add, my dad used to commentate on motor racing, but that day that I had my crash, he was in London about to start the 1977 London City Marathon. So he was in London the day I crashed. So someone else was the lead commentator. Had my dad been there when this gruesome image of me cartwheeling through the air at 100 miles an hour was on camera, I don't know what he would have done. But I was carted off to hospital, badly smashed right leg, and I've had a slight limp ever since. I'm getting a knee replacement this year, which is the after effects of that accident. And I had a bent leg for about 20 years until someone restraightened it. And as a 19, 20-year-old, you're incredibly conscious, especially in Australia where you wear shorts, of the fact that I had a disfigured leg. So I think that did make a difference. And anyway, so yes, I did. I did race in Australia. I was briefly thought of as a someone with future and the potential. And when I came over to Europe, I did race, but very much just more at a club enjoyment level rather than any serious intent. So that's rather a long way of answering your question, Andrew.
No. Well, I'm interested. I've always wondered about motoring journalists who did some racing when they were young and were perhaps pursuing a career in racing. Do you think that experience, that all that circuit driving that you did, stood you in good stead for a career in car journalism, for assessing high performance cars? Is there something in it or not really?
I think it must have done, because it has obviously made you a better driver. And I was also very lucky when I was training to be a driver. When I told my dad I wanted to be a racing driver and I'm serious, he wasn't rich, but he paid for me to do a course at the Frank Gardner Racing Driver School. Now, Andrew will know who Frank Gardner was. Perhaps, Dan, you're too young.
I know exactly who Frank Gardner is.
Yeah. Frank Gardner was a great Australian racing driver in the 60s. European Formula 5000 champion. Competed in 8 or 9 Formula 1 races. Lola test driver. Brabham test driver. Went back to Australia. Wrote a wonderful book called, I think it was called The Motor Racing Handbook or something. Frank Gardner came up with a line: when the flag drops, the bullshit stops. You know, he was a very, very, very witty man, Frank Gardner. And he had a racing driver school. And my dad sent me, before I started doing racing as an 18-year-old, to Frank's course. And Frank, I learnt a hell of a lot from Frank Gardner. And he once said to me, plenty of racing drivers are fast. Not many of them know why they're fast. I know why I'm fast. Frank knew why he was good. And he was very good at communicating that. So he helped me a great deal. So I think with his tuition and racing for a few years, I think it must make you a better driver and probably a better assessor of cars. So I think it did help me, yes.
So how did you get from, well, firstly, what made you decide to come and live in the UK? And how did you get from the news desk of the Sydney Morning Herald to the editor's chair of Car Magazine?
In 1980, I was 23 years old. I think, like a lot of Australians, far more eminent Australians than me. I'm thinking of Barry Humphries, Clive James, who obviously were a fair bit older than me. But I think a lot of Aussies in those days had wanderlust. They wanted to come to the mother country, to come to Europe. I think the impression was Europe was bigger and more interesting and more happening. I certainly had that impression. I have always been very interested in European history and in Europe as a place, not just Britain, but Europe. So that was one reason. I thought if I didn't get out, I would be trapped in Sydney suburbia for the rest of my life. And that was a slightly daunting prospect. That's another reason. I was keen to work in UK journalism, not really motoring journalism, but UK journalism. I used to, when I worked at the Sydney Morning Herald and Sun Herald, I used to go up to the library. And I always thought the quality of journalism on The Observer, The Sunday Times, The Guardian, The Times was certainly a notch above anything I saw in my home country. And then the final thing and the real spark was in 1980, Alan Jones was winning the World Formula One Championship. He went on to be Australia's second world champion after Jack Brabham. But he was getting virtually no publicity. And as someone who was still absolutely fascinated by Formula One, it really annoyed me that Jones, his win in Grand Prix would get a small couple of paragraphs in newspapers under the Sheffield Shield cricket results. And I thought, this is just absurd. This eminent and great Australian racing driver is getting no publicity in his home country. And I thought, I can help, I can fix this. So I saw my newspaper, Wheels Magazine, that's how I first met Peter Robinson. Would he like a feature on Jones? Yes, he would. I saw the editor of a newspaper called Auto Action, which is a bit like Motoring News in Australia. Would you like race reports? Because they didn't have their own man covering the races. Yes, they would. And I approached 3 radio stations, one in Sydney, one in Melbourne, one in Brisbane, saying if I got voice commentary from Jones, so interviewed him after qualifying and after each race, would they run it and pay me? They said yes. So armed with a portfolio of clients, I jumped on the Boeing, flew to Frankfurt and attended the last 3 Grand Prix in Europe of 1980. And that was the Austrian, the Dutch and the Italian, which that year was held in San Marino. And with the idea of following Alan Jones. And I remember turning up at the Austrian Grand Prix in 1980. In those days, it was quite easy for journalists to get accreditation. Not so easy now, but in those days, it was quite easy. And arrogantly thinking, Alan Jones will love to speak to me, because why wouldn't he? And I remember going to qualifying for the first day of the Austrian Grand Prix. It must have been a Friday. Going to the Williams motorhome, and there was a huge queue of journalists, most of them British, out front, thinking, gosh, this is I don't really want to wait in this queue. And being brought up on Australian newspapers, you're taught to be an opportunist. And frankly, if you have to be a bit of an arsehole, that's fine. And just as I was contemplating going to the back of the queue, the motorhome opened, and I could see Alan Jones with his PR lady, who I think was Anne Bradshaw, who I subsequently got to know quite well. And I saw my chance, and I rushed up to him and said, Alan, I'm Gavin Green. I've just arrived from Australia. I'm here. They finally wanted to give you publicity. I'm here for the Sydney Morning Herald, Wheels Magazine, three radio stations, Auto Action. Can I have a word? And he looked at me and said, you can fuck off. So I thought this has not gone well. But again, my Australian newspaper background came to the fore, and I said, oh, come on, Alan, I've just flown all the way. I'm desperately keen to give you publicity. I know you deserve it. And I kept arguing. And he said, oh, okay, then. And he ushered me straight in, much to the complaints of the journalists waiting. And I think it was Anne Bradshaw. So anyway, and in those days, after every qualifying of the next three races and every race, I got an interview with him with his voice on a tape cassette. And then, because I was so poor then, I couldn't even afford hotel rooms, I would have to beg and borrow someone's telephone to put this voice recording on a tape through alligator clips down the telephone line to three radio stations, three times every meeting, once after 2 days after both days of qualifying and the race. But I always got an interview with Alan Jones, and I became quite friendly with him. But in as much as one could be friendly with racing drivers or famous racing drivers. And I went to the Dutch Grand Prix, same sort of thing happened, went to the Italian Grand Prix. I remember at Imola, there was no hotel rooms available. So when I turned up on the Thursday night before qualifying, in those days, most of the circuits had a place where you could turn up, and there was like rooms available. Local people would rent out a bed or a bedroom. That's where I typically would stay. But in Italy, there was no such facility, so there was nowhere to stay. And I spent the Thursday night sleeping literally in a field next to Imola Racing Circuit in some farm field. And I remember the following day on Friday, must have been rather disheveled, going into the pit or paddock. And quite by chance, I met the PR manager of Goodyear Australia, who I vaguely knew from my racing life. I just saw him, and he came up to me and said, oh, hello. I said, hello. And he said, where are you staying? And I said, you see that field over there? I'm sleeping in that. And he said, oh my goodness, we can't have this. So he said, I've got a bedroom in a hotel in Bologna. Would you like to sleep on the floor? So I said, that's fine. So that's where I spent the next two or three nights. But it was an incredibly interesting time, and I really loved it. And that's how I came to be in Europe. I didn't follow the 1981 Formula One season because, frankly, it was too expensive and I wasn't being paid enough to justify it. But during 1981, freelancing for The Guardian, The Express, AP, Reuters, literally doing freelance shifts, which in those days of Fleet Street were actually very easy to get. But during that time, Peter Robinson, who always comes up when you deal with Australian motoring journalists, I had been writing for Wheels. Robbo was over. He said, let's meet up. I've got an Audi Quattro on test. Let's go for a drive together. So I met him at Carr's office in West Smithfield in, I think it was May 1981. I saw Mel Nichols, who I'd never met before. I had met Steve Cropley. Steve was in deputy editor, Mel was the editor. I had met Steve Cropley, who followed a couple of motor races that I'd done, and he got to know me a little bit when I was racing and he was a journalist. And we became sort of friends, not close friends, but friends. So I saw Steve, was introduced to Mel, and he said to me, Robbo said, you know, you should use him, he's a good young writer. And Robbo said, well, have you got any stories you can show me? So I showed him something I'd just written for Wheels, which was a visit to Italy to look at this new Arna, that terrible Alfa-Nissan joint venture thing in 1981.
Nissan Cherry Europe, as it was known. Yeah.
Exactly right. And anyway, Mel looked at the story and ended up running it. And that's how I got into freelancing for Carr. And I so enjoyed working for Carr as a freelancer. And FF Publishing's other titles, which were then executive car, truck, and truck and driver. Clearly, they were commercial titles. But I enjoyed writing for them, working for them more than Fleet Street. So I just freelanced for them more and more and more. And I think Steve Cropley, who then became editor later in 1981, he knew that I was the sort of person that would do anything, go anywhere, work whatever hours he asked me to do. And I think he really respected that and gave me a lot of work. I got a lot of freelance work. And sometime in 1984, for the first time ever, he bought me lunch. And I thought, something's coming up here. Cropley would never buy me lunch. Budgets were very tight in those days, even though we were doing very well. And he said, Gavin, he said, I'd like to offer you a job. He said, in those days, he had one person working from the editorial, and I think there were one person on the art desk. And he said, we need a new person. And I think, frankly, if you hire, there's a fair chance you may succeed me one day as editor. And with that carrot, I said, well, that's very attractive. I said, what's the salary? And he offered me £13,000. And I said, Steve, as a freelance, I earn £23,000. So, but you know what? I took it anyway. And then Cropley left in 1987, and that's when I became editor. So that's really how I got into Car Magazine. And of course, it was the most wonderful place to work because we were owned by Ian Fraser and Andrew Frankel. That's FF Publishing, a small company. In the 80s, our circulation was booming. I think in 86 or 87, we became the best-selling motoring magazine in Britain outright. I think most people...
Can I just leap in here? Because you mentioned Ian Fraser and Andrew Frankel. I'm not
I should have pointed out instantly. astonishingly, there was another Andrew Frankel. I mean, it's not exactly the most common name in Britain, but Andrew Frankel, the advertising Andrew Frankel, has got nothing in common whatsoever with Andrew Frankel. What do you want me to know? And to be fair, Ian Fraser was the guy that really ran the shop. And Ian was a wonderful manager because he was happy to upset car companies. I mean, I have so many memories of Ian coming into the little editorial office, and he'd say, good news, everybody, we've just lost Honda. And we'd go, hooray! And then and then a week later, good news, everybody, we've just lost Volvo. Hooray! And we lost Volvo and Honda and Vauxhall because we pissed them off, basically.
Was that basically at the heart of why Car was so popular and so successful then? Because you would say it as you saw it, and you weren't in the pockets of these car makers, and people respected that.
I think there's a number of reasons, but first of all, Doug Blain and Ian Fraser, who really gave Car its initial culture, they very much were of the view that we are not part of the motor industry. I think most motoring journalists in Britain in the 60s and 70s, some of them are very good writers, technically very strong, you know, some excellent journalists, Lawrence Pomeroy, Ronald Barker, excellent, excellent journalists. But there was the publishers still felt, I think, that they were part of the motor industry. So they were very reluctant to criticise them. Doug Blain and Ian Fraser's view was that we're not part of the motor industry. We're like political commentators. You know, where necessary, we will criticise, and we'll criticise hard. So I think that was one thing. And by criticising, of course, you can be amusing if you're a good writer, and Blain and Fraser were. So that added to the entertainment of the magazine. So I think that was an important factor. And they were very good writers in terms, they were journalistically trained. So I think their natural wordsmith skills were probably higher than was typical at the time. Plus, as time went on, Car really gave excellent graphics, excellent standard photography. That it was the first motoring magazine in the world to have really excellent photos and excellent art direction. And you add all that together, and that's a pretty compelling blend. And it was privately owned, so Ian didn't really care. Ian had enough money and enough success. He was very happy to piss off the car industry. I think that was the culture that I and Steve and Mel, we were all taught that.
So I was just going to say, I think that so much of what you guys were doing, you know, Mel and Steve in the 70s and 80s, and then you, informs what we at TI do today. And to me, as somebody who, you know, I felt the same about Car Magazine as you felt about, you know, Autosport and Motoring News. If it wasn't in the newsagent on the day that you expected to be there. And for me, it was just all about the writers. And you think of, you know, that sort of front line that you had of, you know, of George Bishop and, you know, Leonard Setright and Phil Llewellyn and Russell Bulgin, all gone now. And to me, it was, and this has informed so much of my life and so much what you do at TI, it was a magazine you read for its writing, for its writers, as much of whatever it was they were writing about. You know, those guys, they couldn't write a boring story if they tried. And so it almost didn't matter what they were writing about. And I think what we have tried with the people who, like yourselves, now contribute to the Intercooler is to do exactly that. We put together a lineup of writers that people whose words people just want to read, almost regardless of whatever it is that they're writing about. And that philosophy comes directly from what you guys were doing on Car, you know, 40 years ago.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Andrew. And I also think we all had different voices. I mean, we didn't all say the same thing. I think with most magazines, there is this feeling of what is the editorial opinion. Car, different writers had different views, and that was fine too. We were all individuals. So, and I think when I so it was a wonderful, wonderful time to work. I mean, and I was very privileged to be editor at 30. And I think as Orson Welles once said, I started at the top and I've been working my way down ever since. But you know, it was a wonderful, and I love working there. And Steve was my mentor. Cropley will tell you that Peter Robinson was his mentor. Well, Steve Cropley was my mentor, and Steve Cropley taught me so much, and he's one of my best friends and dearest friends to this day. A wonderful, wonderful man, and a great motoring journalist, and a great man. And you know, and I felt when I took over that I inherited something that was massively successful, and my job was to have a steady hand on the tiller. And I did. I think I made a few good calls. I bought Russell Bulgin in. I felt we needed a younger writer, and that was clearly very good. Later, I bought in James May, and I was very proud of that. Before James was.
What became of him?
Yeah, I don't know what happened to him. I think he's disappeared. but you know, so we brought in a few good people, and I tried, you know, I tried to give the magazine a bit more teeth. When Steve was editor, we had the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, of course, which predated Steve, but the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was, I always thought, incredibly brave that you were categorizing every car in Britain as either being good or boring. So imagine how that pisses off the manufacturers. But Steve, and I think because Steve's a very fair, likable person, he introduced an adequate section in the middle. So we had good, adequate, and boring. I instantly got rid of the adequate because I thought we have to go right back to just the purity of good and boring. So I did that. So I made a few tweaks, but broadly I just kept what Cropley gave me and tried to keep it going for the next 5-6 years that I edited it, but with a few challenges. For instance, FF Publishing sold the company in 1989 to Rupert Murdoch, to Murdoch Magazines. So that was clearly a major challenge, having brand new publishers. As it turned out, they were very good publishers because, unsurprisingly, Rupert Murdoch didn't interfere very much with Car Magazine. He had rather more important publications to worry about. So he just basically gave us a decent budget, improved our distribution, and made Ian Fraser managing director, no longer the owner, but just now the MD. And when Ian wasn't spending his money, he was much more generous with the money, surprisingly. So we all got pay rises. Freelancers got pay rises. Our circulation went up, mainly because, I'd like to say, because the magazine was getting better, but the reality was the distribution was getting much better. And the circulation peaked, I think, in 1991, at numbers that are just unheard of for motoring magazines these days. I think it was 141,000 print copies sold at newsstands, which is just an astonishing number for UK,
that's enormous,
by UK motoring standards. And Colin Goodwin will give you the very number. He remembers it absolutely down to the last digit, but I think it was something like that. And then Murdoch sold it in 1991 to EMAP, and he sold it because Murdoch or News International was going essentially bankrupt because it's hemorrhaging money launching Sky Television, and he had to sell assets to fund Sky, and he sold his magazine interest. So we were then up for sale again, and we were then bought by EMAP, the Peterborough-based publishing house. So I had three different owners that I had to navigate my way around. So it had challenges, but it was still, you know, the most enjoyable time of my life in terms of professionally was, without doubt, was editing Car.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Can we just talk briefly? I don't want to go on too much about this because it's a publication that many listening to this will not have heard of. But
no.
When I was working at Autocar in the early 1990s, we thought we were quite smart and we thought we were quite clever and doing quite well. Mm. And then suddenly we heard about this new publication called Car Week that was coming along, which seemed to us very frightening indeed. And we realized we had to really, really step up our game, not least because it was going to be edited by one G. Green Esquire. And just to just tell us briefly why Car Week came about, why you got involved with it, and why ultimately it didn't last.
Well, I'd rather not, but I will. I guess the best way to start the saga of Car Week is probably to go right back to the days when EMAP bought Car, which, as I said earlier, was in 1991. And I remember they said almost straight away that one of their ambitions was to launch a weekly magazine. They very much saw Car as a launch pad to what they hoped would be domination of the UK motoring magazine market. They were buying the market leader. They clearly thought they were buying some good journalists and some good skills. And they went on to buy Classic Car magazine. They just launched Classic Car Weekly. And they wanted a mainstream weekly magazine. They thought that was essential if they were to dominate the overall motoring market. Also, they had a very good track record at weeklies. They published a very successful motorcycle weekly newspaper called Motorcycle News, which is really the Bible of for motorcyclists. They had a very successful fishing title called Angling Times, again, the sort of Bible for fishermen. They were both weekly newspapers. They're also very strong in classified ads, and EMAP's roots were in regional newspapers, so they understood the newspaper market very well and the weekly market very well. And I think that's why they thought they could come in and beat Auto Express and Autocar, who were the two current weekly magazines. I remember the editorial team of Car, when we were told that their ambition was to launch a weekly, we all thought it was, to be really honest with you, quite bonkers, because there didn't seem to be room for a third weekly. I think we all thought Autocar and Auto Express were doing a reasonable job. Auto Express had only been out for some 3 or 4 years, and they were selling way less than their initial ideas. So, you know, it was a very tough market. Plus, the early 90s, there was a bit of a recession on, you know, car sales were hit. It wasn't a particularly good time to invest in motoring magazines. But nonetheless, EMAP were very, very keen to do it. And despite my skepticism, I guess if enough people tell you that it's a good idea and you get a pay rise and you know, you keep hearing this is going to work, this is going to work, you believe it. So I agreed to be the launch editor, somewhat reluctantly, but the more I heard about it, the more excited I got. And launching it was an extremely exciting, albeit very difficult time. It was extremely hard work. But I think with EMAP's pedigree and Car's pedigree, we were, and helped enormously by some very big budgets, we brought in some very skillful people. We brought in Alan Henry from Autocar to do our Formula One reports. We hired some really strong young people, including Vicky Butler Henderson, who of course went on to great things on television. She was just starting her career then. The format they chose was unusual because of their newspaper background, they wanted a newspaper. That's what Motorcycle News and Angling Times was. The advantage of that was it would give us shorter lead times, easier for classifieds. And classifieds was a major reason for launching a weekly. Neither Autocar nor Auto Express were good at either of those. EMAP had a track record at that. Classifieds, when done well, can be very profitable. So to an extent, we were going after the sort of auto trader market as well. So that's one reason we launched with a newspaper. The actual format was a A3 enhanced tabloid on newsprint, but nice quality, thicker newsprint. I think it was called enhanced newsprint. Full colour heatset publishing, so it looked quite good. The goal was 100,000 copies a week, and that was incredibly ambitious because in those days, Auto Express and Autocar were doing somewhat less than that. I think Auto Express was about 90,000, Autocar about 70,000. So to be the new kid on the block and come along and be instant market leader was obviously extremely ambitious. And it was a monster of a magazine too, an absolute monster of a magazine. We had regional editions. There was a northern edition and a southern edition, mainly to help the classified ads. It had probably twice as many words when it launched as Autocar, and more than twice as many as Auto Express. So it was an absolute monster of a magazine. But sadly, it didn't work. So it was probably the most expensive motoring magazine launch probably in British publishing history, and I doubt whether it will ever be exceeded. I think the launch budget, it certainly ran into the millions. They even had McCann Erickson as an advertising agency taking out advertising advertisements in major newspapers. There was a win in Aston Martin DB7 competition. That wasn't cheap. There was a DB7 on display on the A4 near Earl's Court, I remember. So the goal was 100,000 copies sold. That's what we guaranteed advertisers. When it launched, because of all the promotion, we did hit about 100,000 for the first few issues. But when it settled down, sales declined quite quickly to, I think, about 80,000 in the first 3 months, which is less than break even and considerably less than we had guaranteed the advertisers, and slightly more than Autocar, slightly less than Auto Express. But as the months rolled on, the circulation dipped and dipped and dipped, and I think it settled down to about 50,000, so half of what they'd hoped for. So it was not only the most expensive motoring magazine launch in UK publishing history, it was also probably the biggest financial failure in UK motoring magazine history, which obviously was a bit of a blow. The reasons why it failed, I think the first reason is that I think EMAP felt that they were better at weeklies than Auto Express and Autocar, so there was a certain degree of arrogance. We didn't have a better product than Auto Express or Autocar, so, and when you're the new kid on the block, unless it's a very special product, it won't sell. It wasn't special enough. That means the editorial wasn't good enough. I was the editor. That was clearly my responsibility. I think there was a lot of good stories in it. We had a lot of good staff. We had some good writers. We broke some good news stories. But ultimately, it just didn't offer a fresh enough voice to warrant beating the established magazine. So it didn't work. Another major reason was, the key reason, was that the format was wrong. It was a newspaper, and that might have worked for Motorcycle News and for Angling Times, which had been out for, well, in Motorcycle News' case, some 30 years, Angling Times even longer. When you've got a very regular, loyal readership, you can get away with probably having newspapers. But when you're new, there was a major problem with where we were displayed. When the magazine was launched, it went on a special plinth at newsagents, EMAP paid quite a lot of money for these special plinths so people could see it. Once the promotion ended in the early days, it was hidden with the tabloid newspapers down around your ankle. So it wasn't on display up on the shelves, unlike the A4 glossy magazine. So it's no question the format was a mistake, a huge mistake, because people couldn't see it, couldn't find it. So anyway, for all those reasons, it failed. It's also interesting just to look back on, I remember the early days of when it was being researched. I do recall very clearly some early research being done when we were told that the circulation would be about 50,000 copies. And I remember the management ignored that because it frankly wasn't the number they wanted to hear. They wanted 100,000. The research company went away and did some more number crunching and came back and happily told us the sales would be 100,000, which of course is what the management wanted to hear, and everyone marched on their merry way. But of course, you know, guess what? The circulation did end up at 50,000. So the initial research was absolutely dead right. Anyway, it was a year and a half of my life that I'd probably rather forget in a professional sense.
I mean, I was always very grateful for it because, you know, at Autocar, we had to suddenly step up because there was this, to us, what seemed to be an existential threat. We suddenly realised that actually we hadn't been trying that hard at all. And I think that when I look back, you know, I was on Autocar from 88 to 96. And if I look back at the issues that I'm most proud of, it is no coincidence. They're all those issues that came out around the time that Car Week launched, because we suddenly realised we had to just completely raise our game. And that's when I kind of really learned just how hard I could work, just how hard we needed to think, how creative and imaginative. And I think an awful lot of that learning stayed with me.
That's right. Well, and towards the end of it too, even though after I'd stepped down as editor, I was on the EMAP sort of management board area thing. And I remember there was a very advanced discussions to merge Car Week with Auto Express, because in those days the Auto Express was owned by the Daily Express and by Axel Springer, the German company, and there was talk about EMAP essentially taking the Daily Express's share of it. So there were quite advanced discussions in merging those two titles, and I think had they merged, they would have called it Car Week. That was thought to be the better name. But with a mixture of the staff from both, and they went quite a long way down the path before eventually I think it was decided that the deal wasn't right and it never happened, and eventually Car Week closed. And it's interesting because EMAP, they lost a lot of self confidence from that. I remember one of the projects I worked on afterwards for EMAP was a magazine that we called Petrol, which was a bit like it had a little bit of Max Power's edginess. Max Power was a very successful sort of lads motoring magazine in the 90s. The best-selling motoring magazine in Britain through much of the mid to late 90s. But this magazine was a little bit of Max Power's sort of youthful edginess, but much more serious journalism. And we got to really advanced dummies. And I always thought that was a very promising magazine. But at the last minute, when I'd go to the management board to present, please, can we have the money to launch it? They never said yes. And I often wonder what would have happened had that launched, because I thought it would have been quite a fun magazine. A guy called Bill Thomas, who you would know, Andrew, he was going to be the editor. A very, very sharp, clever guy. I used to work on Max Power. He's now the PR boss for Hyundai in Australia.
All right, so I'm interested to get your view, Gavin, on what's happened to car media, UK car magazines, UK car journalism in the sort of two or three decades since this period. What do you think it's done well, and what do you think's changed, perhaps not for the better?
That's a really hard question. I mean, obviously what happened in the mid-90s, I stepped down from Car at exactly the right time, because that was just at the birth of the internet and the birth of Top Gear. And Top Gear clearly changed the dynamics with the huge backing of the television program and Jeremy's rise to fame. You know, it became the best-selling motoring. Well, actually, Max Power did, but if you exclude the weirdness of Max Power, Top Gear became the dominant mainstream magazine. So, and Car, you know, that Car suffered, and you know, the reality is it's probably suffered a bit ever since. It's certainly not the number one selling print title, which it had been. Top Gear became the dominant print magazine. I think, I mean, since then, you know, the whole business has changed so much. I mean, there was no internet when I edited Car. You know, print magazine circulations, all of them are way down on what they were, but you'd expect that. On the other hand, the readership, I mean, I think someone told me the other day, Car's readership is now higher than it's ever been because of the digital side. So, you know, it's wrong to say it's not as successful as it was. It's simply not as successful as a print product. And I think it's fascinating. You guys have, you know, launched something new and interesting, and you know the market has just changed so much and altered so much. Where it's going to go, to be honest with you, Dan, you probably have a better idea than I do.
Well, I hope so. I don't know, but we'll see. I mean, it's fascinating to hear you talk about it. I mean, I often feel like I missed the golden era of car journalism, particularly on the magazine side. You know, I hear guys like, well, both of you talk, and Goodwin and Sutcliffe and Harris, you know, all these guys who worked on the big magazines 20 or 30 years ago. And I hear the stories, I hear about the budgets, I hear about the clout, and I just think, I've never worked on a title and felt quite the same way. I feel like when I've worked on magazines, they've been in a sort of steady state of decline. You know, they're getting smaller, fewer pages, budgets getting trimmed. On the other hand, as you've pointed out, on the digital side, I think car media brands must now be reaching more people than they ever have done. So it's this curious mix of, you know, growth in one sense and decline in another. So it's a curious time, but it feels like the right time for a digital startup to come along and try and disrupt it, which is exactly what we're trying to do. But we don't need to talk about us too much.
No, but you're also right about things like budgets, because you know, we would go on 2-3 day photo shoots, and now often magazines would ask for a bit of help from car companies for certain big jobs. We never did that. We always self-funded. We'd go on press launches because everyone did that. But in terms of our own jobs, we always did it ourselves. And, you know, we had some extremely big budgets. We'd go all over the place. We, you know, went to the Sahara Desert. We'd go, you know, around the world sometimes. Because we had enough, we sold enough copies and had enough ad revenue to make it profitable. And the one thing with digital, of course, it's the margins are much, much finer. So I think salaries were probably at least as high then, maybe higher than they are now. And I don't even mean relatively, I mean in absolute terms, because as Andrew said, in the early 90s, it was a very competitive area and good editors and good journalists were getting pay rises. My pay went up massively in the late 80s, early 90s, because of particularly when Car Week started launching. So because people like us were in demand. So now I think margins are much finer. Motoring journalists, freelancers, the rates generally aren't very good in most magazines or newspapers. So it's very hard to make a living unless you do, you have to do some commercial work, but, you know, script writing or something, because otherwise it's very hard to make ends meet as a freelance. And that wasn't true 20, 30 years ago either. So, you know, there are some unfortunate trends. I also think that the way the car detached itself from the motor industry and really was critical of the industry, I think that's still a lesson. I think all, you know, any journalists in an area of speciality, that was a model that people need to look at. The fact that you're not part of the motor industry, you're commentating on it. By all means, compliment good cars, but be critical of bad ones. It's harder now because cars aren't as bad as they were then. It was much easier to be critical of some quite poor cars than it is today. Now, I think the biggest criticism of most cars are they're probably rather boring. But that's a harder criticism than the ride's right. Rubbish or the damping's rubbish or the engine's rubbish. So
that's right. And I suppose it's easy to be hypercritical and be funny with it when you have clout, when you have an enormous audience, and when you're a successful brand, car media brand.
Yeah.
It's more difficult when you do need the support of the industry, isn't it? And actually, you know, it's one thing that we think, among many things we have going for us, is that we don't carry any advertising at all, certainly not from car manufacturers. And new cars are not what we're all about. So, you know, if we upset someone by sharing an honest opinion, so be it.
No, I agree. But, and you're right, I think one of the wonderful things about working there, and that really happy, I've got a happy life now, but it was a very happy life then as well, was that... You know, we did have clout, and the car industry, you know, they knew we mattered. And that's why Ian Fraser could laugh at losing advertising, because it really didn't matter very much. Someone else would come along instead. And that is very rare today, I think. You'd be a brave publisher to laugh at losing a major advertiser. But Ian was quite happy to do that.
Wow. So what's kept you busy apart from writing for car magazines over the last few years? I think you've done work for car manufacturers, other bits and pieces.
I wrote for the British Airways magazine regularly until COVID sort of grounded it. I write for Car Graphic in Japan. I do commercial work for mainly agencies, marketing agencies, advertising agencies, people who may be pitching for new businesses might ask me for some insight into their brand or why they're strong or why they're weak. I've worked for a content agency called Redwood, which funnily enough was the BBC Redwood was the company that launched Top Gear magazine. Then BBC and Redwood broke off into two, and Redwood went off more into what you'd now call content marketing. So I've done some consultancy work for them. So at the moment, Dan, it's a mixture of journalism for Car magazine, for you. It was for the British Airways magazine when it appeared. Car Graphic in Japan, a few other people here and there. And script writing, speech writing, commercial books. Yeah. I've done books for a few different people. I've just done a book for Sunseeker Luxury Yachts, which is a bit of a weird one, but I quite enjoy doing that. So it's a very varied portfolio. Most of it I can do from home, which I enjoy. So, and I'm busy without being stupidly busy. So it's really quite a nice balance.
And what Gavin's obviously far too modest to say this, but I'll say it for him. He is a fantastic writer. A brilliant turn of phrase. Also hugely knowledgeable, massively experienced, of course. But, I mean, if you haven't read his piece for The Intercooler called The Joy of Maps, go and read it. He writes this wonderful piece about maps and somehow makes it really moving and entertaining and insightful. And he's clearly not going to sit here and say he can do that. But someone needs to stand up and say he's had this career because he's a fantastic writer.
It's very kind of you to say that. And I've enjoyed writing about cars for, well, it's now 40 years, and it's just... And I think, like you two, I've always felt very privileged to be able to do this, and to have my career writing about something I really enjoy is just a huge privilege. So I've always found myself to be, you know, enormously lucky, really. So and long may
well,
continue.
Well, we are quite right. We are delighted to have you on our writing team. Yeah. Now, before we let you go, both of you, I want both of you to chip in on this. I want your views. We're going to do What Goes Up Now, which is our market segment where we look at what's going on in the marketplace. And this time we're talking about the car industry as a whole, because it is 3 years since, in the UK, it is 3 years, actually just over 3 years, since we went into the first COVID lockdown. And so I want to look at how the car industry has recovered since then. Now, as we know, COVID caused a massive shock to the new car sector, to new car manufacturing. The number of cars coming off the end of production lines just plummeted for a while. But that was quickly followed up by the semiconductor shortage, quickly followed up by the war in Ukraine. Brexit was going on at the same time as well. And now there are shipping problems in Germany, particularly affecting VW Group. All of these things have hit new car manufacturing, and it meant that new car supply was on the ground for a long, long time. A consequence of that was that used car values rocketed. And we know that the used car market for a while was in this very, very odd place where values were sky high and people, in many cases, were selling cars that they had for a year or 2 years for a profit, or at least getting their money back.
I was one of them.
Well, there you go. And if either of you two remember a similar time, you'll have to let me know. But it feels like it's unprecedented.
I think there are two things going on here. I mean, firstly, there was the supply shortage caused by the chip crisis, which caused secondhand car prices to rise and stay risen. But actually, I think there's something far more fundamental going on than that, which is that, you know, with Ford canning the Fiesta, being the kind of the archetypal example of this, you know, car manufacturers don't seem that interested in making affordable cars anymore. And actually, I don't think they can make affordable EVs anymore. You know, when you have the cheapest Vauxhall Corsa costing something beginning with a 3, so you ask yourself the question, you're the sort of person who might be knocking about in a Fiesta, which maybe costs 15 grand. Well, and you need a new car. Well, how and are you going to be able to spend twice that much on an EV, which, you know, might well not suit your life because you don't have a second car option. You live in a terrace house in the middle of a town, and it's very difficult to use. So, you know, I mean, certainly everybody I've spoken to is in that position. They all just say the same thing. They just say we're going to hang on to our existing car, and while you have that view, new car sales are going to be kept down. And I just wonder how sustainable this new approach of, you know, not making small affordable cars and just making really expensive. I don't know how sustainable that is. So I think, you know, I think it is that every bit as much as, you know, the sort of short-term chip crisis, which is still existing, but it's nothing like as bad as it was, which is causing the reduction in sales in the second-hand car market and the maintenance of very, very high value of second-hand cars. Yeah. People just, if they haven't, they won't sell them.
And you've got astonishing things happening like Ford, you know, the market leader for, 30 years, essentially abandoning, in many ways, the mass market, you know, Fiestas, Focuses, and instead gravitating towards things like this Explorer, electric Explorer, which is, you know, and you think, it's astonishing how, I think what's happened during the COVID period, a lot of manufacturers have actually made almost more profits than ever with fewer sales. So they realize the thing to do is to prioritize the profitable models, the high margin models, and not the other ones. And that just feeds the problem that you just mentioned, Andrew. Increasingly, they're pushing their money into expensive cars because that's what they can make more money
on. So what I think is going to happen, I'll rephrase that. What is happening is that the Chinese will jump in and fill the gap.
Yeah, I think that's right.
You know, in the same way that, you know, the Japanese did in the 70s and the 80s and the Koreans did in the 90s and noughties, I think the Chinese, you know, and if you look at a car like, you know, an MG4, which costs so much less than an ID3, frankly, a better car, I think that's what's going to happen. I think that they have created a situation, opened up a massive gap in the market into which the Chinese seem to be, you know, ready, willing, and able to leap. So, and I think they'll regret it. You abandon that territory at your peril, because apart from anything else, you know, the person who buys, you know, the young person who buys their first car, maybe they buy a second-hand Ford Fiesta or whatever, you know, they buy a good car, great car. You know, they might be buying Fords for the rest of their lives. But if they don't do that, they go and buy an MG instead because it's the only EV they can actually afford, then you never even get to find out who they are, let alone enjoy their business for the next 40 years. I just think it's really short-sighted.
Jim Holder from Autocar tweeted yesterday, I think, that the average price of a new car in the UK this month is £48,000.
That's ridiculous.
Average price, £48,000.
That's absolutely
so absurd. I now probably can't afford the average car in the UK, which is just astonishing. So also this from Autocar on the subject of the recovery, how things are rebounding. Autocar 4 weeks ago wrote that the UK new car market achieved an eighth consecutive month of growth in March, according to the SMMT. So things are clearly getting back, perhaps not to where they were, but recovering. And this quarter, the first quarter of 2023, has been the best first quarter performance since 2019. However, the market is still down almost 30% compared to the same period in 2019. So things are looking better, but still a long way off, a long, long way off where we were before COVID. Now, to paint a bit of a picture, I asked a question on Twitter. I did a bit of a survey of my followers to try and understand what normal people are seeing out there in the marketplace. This is all anecdotal, but it's interesting and it paints a mixed picture. So I'm just going to run through a handful of these responses. Somebody said, I'm a stock manager for a franchise dealer, so I deal with both new and used cars. I can confirm that new car supply issues are far from over as yet, and that used prices are still very strong. Good stock is becoming increasingly difficult to get hold of. Someone said, try waiting for a VW T6 combi. 25 months and counting, no ETA on delivery or explanation. Let's just do a couple more. I ordered a Skoda Octavia VRS Estate in November 2021, still no build date. I sold a car on eBay in 12 minutes this week. It was just a cheap Mondeo. But in 12 minutes after the advert going live, someone had bought it at the buy it now price. A couple more. I had to settle for a two-year-old ex-dealer demo Land Rover Defender with an extended warranty because it was going to take 15 months for a brand new one to arrive. Someone else said, availability is easy on most cars I'm interested in, and I've negotiated well on used cars, almost normal in my opinion. So, I mean, there's a spread of insights there, of experiences there. But it's quite clear that some people are still feeling that it's very difficult to get hold of a new car, and therefore used cars are worth an awful lot of money. One more point. So we work with a car finance company, JBR Capital, and it is literally their job to understand what's going on with used car values month by month in this country. I asked them to look into this for us, and they said during the early stages of the pandemic, we witnessed a surge in demand for used cars, leading to a spike in prices. We know that happened. A lot has changed since then, and there's been some stabilization in the used car market. Price fluctuations have certainly calmed as supply has increased. This can be reflected in the high-end sector, as prices for luxury cars and supercars have, in many cases, stabilized in the past 6 months. What Goes Up is sponsored this week by car finance specialist JBR Capital. We've been working with JBR Capital for a while now, and it's been a brilliant partnership for us. High-end car finance is all the company does, meaning it understands the car market and car buyers better than most. So before you buy your next sports car, supercar, classic car, luxury car, even a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. Visit jbrcapital.com or click the link in description. And this bit is important. Tell them the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. I suppose it suggests that we're not back to where we were. We are still seeing these weird market distortions. But perhaps progress is being made. We're on our way back to where it needs to be. Gavin, what do you think? Are you seeing this?
I think that's probably the case, but I also think we're in a position of such extraordinary flux at the moment within the car industry. I mean, Andrew mentioned the Chinese coming, and I think he's right. I think this is a huge concern to Europe's car makers, that essentially they're giving up in the fight against the Chinese in that mainstream market. And of course, once they get in the mainstream market, they'll go up market. So I think Europe's in a very, very dangerous position with its motor industry.
But it's their fault. You know, they've abandoned the territory. They've opened the door. They let them in. They can't complain.
So I think we're going to see the most enormous changes as we transition towards electric cars, with, I'm afraid, the balance moving towards China and Korea, probably in that order. Japan, I think, definitely third in Asia, certainly behind Korea and China. But sadly, the Chinese, it's already the world's biggest EV market. They're the world's biggest maker of EV batteries, the world's biggest miner of the precious metal in batteries. Companies like BYD are frighteningly profitable. I think it's a very dangerous time for the West, probably particularly Europe. I think America, obviously, there's a fair bit of protectionism in America now. They've got the strength of Tesla. But Europe hasn't really got that. So I do think it's a very dangerous time for the European car industry. And that is something that I personally find sad, because, I live in Europe and you want a strong car industry in this country. It's extremely important for jobs and everything else. And yet, I think because so many car makers, not least Volkswagen, are transitioning towards China anyway, they're not making this point. I think the person yelling loudest is probably Carlos Tavares at Stellantis, who's been saying this for ages, probably partly because they're quite weak in China, so we can afford to. But, I just think a lot of these warnings have fallen on deaf ears. And unless we start getting our act together pretty quickly, I do fear that the motor industry in this country is going to massively contract with a great deal of loss of skills, expertise and jobs.
Blimey. Well, we'll see how it unfolds, but we have to leave it there. Gavin, thank you so much for coming on. It's been fascinating to hear you talk.
Fascinating.
And we are very much looking forward to you filing more copy, because we love your stories.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Dan. Thank you very much, Andrew. And thank you, everybody.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. cotton. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.